who's presently the Undersecretary of the Air Force. And he brings to us a background of engineering from the point of view of both industry, from his former association as president of the MITRE Corporation, and now from the point of view of the government and military aspect. Next to him is Cy Herwald, who, as you know, is the junior past president of IEEE and is also vice president of Westinghouse, who brings to us both the engineering institutional background as well as a strong industrial background. Next is Professor William Linville from Stanford University, who, as an educator in the system engineering field, brings us a broad background in both education and engineering. Next, a speaker who is not on your agenda, but who has been added to the session, is Vladimir Sefarov, who is the head of the Popov Society of the USSR and the head of a Soviet delegation who is visiting us here at this meeting, who will read to us a prepared speech in English, which is quite akin to what we are talking about. This will give us a background from where engineering is headed from other than the United States. Next, we have Dr. Eric Walker, who has a dual role, both as the president of Penn State College and also as the Penn State University. I'm sorry. Big difference. Thank you. As well as the president of the National Academy of Engineering. And sitting on the end is Tom Rogers, who is in the Office of Research and Development from the Housing and Urban Development Department. And will give us a broad background from the government point of view of both the military and non-military aspects of engineering and government. Now, we've decided to be perfectly fair about this. We thought we would present the speeches in alphabetical order, so there would be a very simple algorithm to follow, because it gets confusing if it's more difficult. And therefore, our first speaker will be Cy Herwald.
No, it just shows you've got to be pretty careful in any explanation that you get. I didn't happen to be at the luncheon, so I think the real reason is that they looked around for some rationale to find the first speaker and took the one that wasn't there and then worked backwards and found out it was the top of the... I think it'd been the other way around if Z was missing. Before you do any talking, I always think it's wise in a meeting of this kind to try to, at least in a broad way, describe your own philosophy to some extent so that you can judge accordingly, because what comes out usually is flavored by what that background is, and I think you got to have both the background to judge against what's said. So let me just tell you that I happen to be a gray man, as the broadest way of describing my feelings, is that I don't know anything that's either black or white. Now, it's easy to describe black and it's easy to describe white, but it's pretty tough to describe a shade of gray because it's more complex. And this makes it a lot tougher for me to philosophically set myself into all the tough, complex problems that we face modern-wise, because I don't think you solve them by black or white solutions. I think there's some that are somewhat better than others, but the alternates aren't as clear as black or white. So when you ask me what direction is electrical engineering going into, I think my prime answer would be it's going in the direction of where the problems requiring the application of technology for economic solution are going. It's about the best way I can describe it. And I can say that I think that engineers are going to contribute in their own way toward which direction that is. In one of the discussions yesterday, it certainly comes up. I think engineers have as diverse views as to where the general society ought to go as any other group of people. I don't think they're polarized in one direction or another. I think that we've got all shades of gray of opinions in the engineering profession. So let me talk about the three main trends that I see. One is a very long-term one that's been going on for quite a while, and it relates to engineering. And because I think things are neither black or white, I don't think there is any technological innovation that has good in it that also doesn't have some bad associated with it. That there's nothing that's invented that's perfect, and as a consequence, there's trailer effects to everything that you could say are on the black side, whereas all the good features are on the white side. because of economy of scale. Whether you want to start back when the cavemen were chipping flint, and they had some good flint chippers, some poor ones, and they began to lump them together, or whether you talked about trade, or whether you talked about moving into the area of economy of scale in farming or in manufacturing, up to now at least, bringing things together made them more economic. And this trend's been going on for a long time. We're now reaching the point in my mind where the people density problem associated with that economy of scale has got enough secondary side effects that we've got some real problems to look at in those areas. These show up in pollution in my mind, in waste, talk about the slums, because any one of those things occurring in small amounts isn't a problem. A little bit of pollution in a creek upstream from a mine isn't a problem. But a lot of mines and a lot of people living along that creek and doing things, it does become a problem. So we've got some redressing to do in my mind on the balance of what we're taking out versus what we're putting in. And these are mightily related in my mind, again, to the people density problem. The second one is, let me say that we are reaching limits in many things that for generations before us weren't limits. And maybe I'm stupid, because if you look back in history, you can always read the books and say that we reached limits in everything else, and we went through them, and the speed of sound is the classic one from my generation that, you know, you couldn't get through it, and we did. Except I think I'm talking about more fundamental limits. Like, at least for the near time future, we're going to be somewhat constrained in what we can do outside the Earth's gravity belt, really, for a lot of people. So we're constrained on the bounds of the Earth, and when you if you'll accept that and say I'm not too myopic in looking at it, we've got a lot of things approaching limits. Let me take a few stupid examples. It used to take months by ship to deliver mail person to person. An airplane long downstream from those early ships, still working person to person, though, through a net that was essentially aimed person to person, didn't speed up the communications, really, people to people, quite that much. But now let's skip into the satellite area, where we are right now. And with not much extrapolation, you can almost think of groups of people or whole areas of people talking to other whole areas almost instantaneously. And I'm not sure that isn't approaching a limit, and a pretty fundamental limit. You're going to, if you want to take other examples, you can take the a trip to Europe by ship, you can do it by plane, and you can extrapolate it to SST. Well, 2.5 hours isn't far from zero, and I think zero is the limit in that case. So the point I'm making is I think after a long period, the aim that we always had was to do things on a faster, bigger, some other kind of scale. And if you just make the one assumption that you're going to be earthbound for a while, the real question is, how much farther can you go in some of the fundamentals? And this again creates a problem, because you no longer can project all your trends on a straight line upward. Now let's take one more third one, and I will close off, is that we're now, with our people density, with approaching the limits, with bounding it by the Earth, if you accept all those, we're on a closed system. So we're going to have a lot more of our effort devoted toward closed loop economics, if you want to call it that. And the reason I use economics is I think engineering solves economic problems, in contrast to digging out new tools with which to solve these problems. And that's a muddy solution, and I'll drop it right after saying that. But take the simple cases. Take mining. Someplace we're going to have to start accounting for the byproducts of what comes out of the mining as well as your mining, and pretty fast. Take any one that you want, automotive transportation. Someplace we're going to have to arrive at a different compromise on the byproducts. I don't care which one you pick, but they're all closed loop. As simple as one has come up yesterday. What about the tin cans that we're piling up that are supposedly disposable but aren't really disposable? What are you going to do about that problem of recycling? And I think we've got a recycling problem on water. I think we've got a recycling problem on pollution. I think we've got a recycling problem on many things that we're going to have to start thinking about using over and over and over again, because we're about at the limit of what you can do by using them once. So where's the trend of engineering going? I'm going to go into solving those kind of problems, because those are the kinds I see coming up. They take all the skills we've developed in systems engineering, so-called plus, and they're going to take that whole bank of technology we've stored up over the years and plus, and maybe I'm biased again, but I think the people best qualified to work on these solutions and get them economically are engineers. And it's only going to take some kind of reordering of our economic ground rules. And again, I'll make it very simple. Our ground rules are now set up for an open-loop system on economics. Very few penalties on the disposal part of the economics. In some way that either I may not like or you may not like, but in some way that the people in general like, we're going to change some of the economic ground rules by a part of the debate that's going on now. And with that new set of ground rules, the same fellows making the design compromises now within that framework are going to start making different compromises, and that's where I think the engineering profession's gone.
I guess if I were to define where electrical engineering is going, the first thing I would have to do is tell you how I view electrical engineering. To me, the electron part of it, or the electrical part, the fact that it is electrical, is not any longer the dominating consideration. Electrical engineers are terribly important in the future because they've had such a part and will continue to have such a dominatingly important part in the technology of computers and television and communication and control, broadly viewed, among many other situations. So I would, the modifier electrical is not terribly meaningful anymore. But the word engineering is even more, I just agree completely with Cy. The meaning for engineering, the meaning of engineering, that is the person who takes responsibility to do something. That becomes even more important in the future than it has in the past. I think that our society is in the environment of a cascade of technological revolutions. We're not really interested in a single revolution. The whole society is going to be recycled. And when I was a student, we were trained for a career which we expected to last a lifetime. I think that the people that we're training now may have three careers or four careers in the lifetime. The thing I'm interested in is cycling the society. We think that we're in the middle of a revolution, but there are several of these happening. In the past 20 years, there have been at least a half dozen revolutions that seem to me to be equally important so far as societal considerations are concerned with the printing press. Four of them that I mentioned, electrical engineers have been very, very closely identified with. And the problem, it seems to me, is that it's not possible to separate the technical issues from the other issues. This decade has been the decade, it seems to me, of computers and automation. And those of us who've worked in that area find that you can't separate the management issues from the technological issues. The manager oftentimes knows what's managerially feasible, but he only knows what's technologically available. The engineer knows what's technologically feasible, but only knows what's managerially available in the traditional view. The interesting situation is where we get people together who can talk about what's feasible in both of those branches. That's the key idea. Now, that's the present decade. And that's in the, what I would call, the microsystem area. The new situation that's coming up is a situation that involves the macro system area, not the micro system area. Now the whole society is facing, is going to be facing, a set of revolutionary changes which affect the whole society. And the problem now is one of combining sociological issues and technological issues. And this requires a level of exploration of the issues that's now sort of the big brother, the broad scope extension of what we've seen going on already with automation. Our society, I think, now has to find ways of cycling through exploratory processes. And I just have two words that I want to leave with you. Just two. There are two different modes of life. And if you're going through on a one-cycle basis, as we have in the past, once in a lifetime, we start going through the first mode at the beginning of our life, and then we gradually transfer to the other mode and live out our lives in the second mode. Now we're going to cycle through that mode several times. The two modes of life are the exploratory mode and the operational mode. Now, the exploratory mode is like a circle. And the operational mode is like an arrow. And if you're in a situation, whenever you're in a situation that's radically new and radically different, so that the object is to illuminate a new situation, you must go into the exploratory mode. The exploratory mode is a temporary mode. It doesn't have a leader. It has a chairman for that activity. Now represent the circle with arrows going from the circle to the point in the center. Now, the arrows come from different points. That implies that people who do the exploration come to the exploratory process from a set of different points of view. There isn't the chairman. The thing that focuses their investigation is that they're all looking at a common problem. And the problem focus then supplants the usual leader. That is, so exploration is a multidisciplinary term process. We have to decide what the demand, for example, of the society is. So sociologists have to be involved. Psychologists have to be involved. Economists have to be involved. Obviously, technologists have to be involved. And the only way that people from these diverse backgrounds can get together is to focus on a specific problem. This is a new way of life. Now, the operational mode is the conventional mode that we're already familiar with. That's the one that has a leader, a strong hierarchy, a specific goal. Efficiency is terribly important. And the thing that's critical, so far as our society is concerned, is that we now have to cycle through, as a society, successive cycles of exploration and operation, new operation, and so on. Now, the language, because this process is important, it's going to happen many times, we have to develop a new language for it. The language for this exploration, operation, transition, I think, is system analysis. And it's terribly important that in our society, we get groups who are responsible for the exploratory process. Right now, we talk about the last point that I want to make is this. We talk about our society being moving from a situation where we've had a deficiency in food, shelter, and clothing to where we have a sufficiency. And our society has to move now from a deficiency need state to a growth need state. And none of us know about that. We have to do exploration. We have to discover what the desires and demands of the society are. So we need two new things. This language to do the exploration, and a language, efficient language for the transfer, and we need some new organizations to help in this process. And it seems to me that the new electrical engineers will become the new engineers who will be the people who do the building, who are the responsible developers of technology in its application to meet the new needs of society.
That was Professor Linville of Stanford. Our next speaker is Dr. Rogers of HUD. Well, I'm sorry, out of order. How could I forget? I'm sorry. I can't read the alphabet. That's my problem. Dr. McLucas.
They say one of the trouble with engineers is they don't learn to read, but I'm not sure that applies to them. Well, I was told not to be bound too closely by this particular subject, electrical engineering, and so I hope not to be. And I wasn't even going to draw a distinction between science and engineering, but somewhere in this general area there's a subject that deserves some thought as to where it's all leading us and where we want to go. Is it taking us where we don't want to go? Seems to me that the engineering student and the engineering practitioner, or the scientist, is caught up he's in a bind right now because he's being pulled in many different directions. If you're a student and you want to be an engineer, then they tell you that you must take all these basic sciences because courses in basic sciences because engineering is now merging with science. And you must take courses in economics because you must be concerned with whether or not we can afford some of your vast ideas. And more recently, we have to be more conversant with some of the social effects of our vast engineering projects. I think what I'm leading to is that there is a responsibility both on the part of the practicing engineer and the incipient engineer to broaden his fields of interest to the point where he can cope with not only the subject matter that he thought he was becoming involved in, but the effects on the society as a whole. There was a time when the engineer could think of his role as being constructive. In other words, there were specific engineering jobs that needed to be done, and he operated more or less in a fixed environment. If you were building a bridge across a river, this did not affect the world. It just affected your ability to cross the river. But as we go further and further in creating vast engineering projects, we do gradually affect the environment. And in fact, the process of generation of power at the moment is changing the balance of CO2 in the atmosphere at a significant rate, so that if you extrapolate that current rate for 100 years, it really could have an effect on life on the planet. So there are things like this, which we all of a sudden have to take into account, which when we operate on a smaller scale with smaller numbers of people, we could ignore. So I think the role of the engineer, although it might continue to be constructive, must be re-examined in the light of how much of what he is doing is constructive in a net way, because for every project he undertakes, he's doing this at the cost of perhaps noise or creation of pollution of one kind or another, aesthetic effects and changes in the environment, running highways through people's backyards or whatever it may be. So here we're stuck with the social effects of engineering activity. I think that this is not a serious problem to us if we put our minds to it. It's mainly a question of allocation of thought, resources, and time to take account of these effects, which we have tended to ignore. Now, I don't want to speak too much about this because it seems to me that many of us get so preoccupied with the bad effects, or side effects, if you want to call it, of our technological society that we think maybe it'd be better off if we didn't have it. So, in effect, what the critics of this type are saying is we should turn back the clock about 300 years. Well, we have many countries in the world today which are at the stage we were at 300 years ago, and I don't think that we want to go back there. And I think they would like to have some of the problems that we have. But we can no longer continue to ignore the side effects of our technology. I don't think we have, in general, technological gaps in how to deal with these side effects. I think it's mainly a psychological gap or a management gap. We haven't quite decided how to deal with the issues, but the technology is there if we will just harness it and use the same creativity in dealing with these bad effects as we used in creating these engineering projects in the first place. Now, I must admit that there is some ignorance still here as to what we're doing to the environment. Just to take a simple case, as we fly jets at high altitudes, and there are hundreds of them in the air all the time, creating contrails, there's quite a concern in some fields about what this is doing to the weather on the planet. And I think there are enough statistics to show that the presence of contrails can have an effect on weather. But we don't know in what direction it's driving us. In other words, is there a net heat loss or a net heat gain? And it depends on the geometry of the case, whether the sun's at a low angle or high angle and so on. So here's a case where we really do need to know more about what's happening. But in general, most of the things that are happening are things that we do have the technology available to try to straighten things out if we just put our minds to it. Many of the problems are going to require organizing on a rather large scale. Well, we've already had experience with this. With my military background, for a moment, I'll just mention some of the large systems that the military has put together and how the net effect of this has been to create an industry and a management structure which allows us to deal with those problems. Therefore, when we face these large civil problems, such as creating a transportation system for the country, rebuilding cities, projects of this size, we have had experience in building vast systems. And I don't mean to say that the civilian side has all that much to learn from the military, but I think there is a gap between what has been applied and what can be applied. As we deal with some of these large projects, it seems to me you create a dichotomy in the engineering profession between those who want to remain concerned with what I'll call engineering in the small, where they want to be experts in the transistors or whatever it may be, and engineering in the large, which you might call systems engineering, and a dichotomy of interest then between those who want to specialize in engineering as such or those who want to branch off into what the effects of these systems may be. So, again, comparing the role of the engineer and the role of the student, they both have the same problem. In the case of the student, what type of background do you think will prepare you to deal with the problems of the future? But for the engineer himself, which of these areas appeals to you, and how can you, at a given stage in your engineering career, broaden your background and training to the point where you can be effective in dealing with some of the problems which our engineering works are creating for us? I think many of us, of my generation at least, have become preoccupied with the technology almost as an end in itself. We've done things because they were possible. And as an engineering manager, I've had this problem with many of our engineers where instead of doing it the simplest way, they wanted to do it the most elegant way. But the same criticism could be made of the engineering manager that he wanted to work on the most elegant programs and so on up through the whole system to where We have regarded technological innovation as an end in itself in many cases. I'm not sure that's necessarily bad, but I don't think it's sufficient. And certainly when I talk to my children, for example, they wonder how we got so preoccupied with this. And they say, that's not our bag. We're more concerned with where this is all taking us than we are with just doing engineering for its own sake. So maybe we have to wait for the next generation to straighten us out. I'm not sure. It's good because we did it, I think, is the way many of us look at it. It must have been good. Well, to conclude here, it seems to me that what I'm trying to say is that we should make our goal having technology serve the needs of man and not vice versa. Thank you.
Our next speaker will be Dr. Rogers. I believe I've got the alphabet right now.
Gentlemen, thank you, Mr. Rowe. Title, Where is the Electrical Engineering Profession Headed? Except for drawing attention to my professional background, that of a physicist, an electronics engineer, I will confine my observations to the urban scene in the light of my experience as the director of research in the Department of Housing and Urban Development for the past 2 years. I would like to modify, in a fashion as John McLucas has, the title to include that of the scientist, and rather ask the question, where are some of our electrical and electronics engineers headed? I'd like to include scientists for reasons that I'll touch upon later, and I'd like you to know that I'm going to be speaking against a background of concern over the past 2 years, not with military systems or space systems as I had been for perhaps all of my professional career, but rather with concerns for housing, building new communities, rebuilding our present cities, public facilities and services, improving the efficiency and effectiveness of local administration, and wondering how one evaluates massive federal urban programs. Now, I'd say some scientists, some electrical and electronics engineers, because certainly for some time to come, most scientists and engineers concerned with the broad fields of electricity and electronics undoubtedly will continue to develop the by now fairly well-known fields of power, power sources, energy transmission, space, defense, commercial ADP, television, so on. But many will begin to make the transition to the study of urban problems and the development of solutions to urban problems. Those that do will, to a greater or lesser extent, experience some novel problems, some complex, some foreign, some stubborn, and even at times frightening problems. In some areas, the transition probably should not be quite as difficult as in others. And I have in mind such areas as information and management systems for local communities, air traffic control, mass transportation. Since these areas have a relatively high technological content, have attracted some professionals at the federal, state, and local level, and can profit rather directly from studies made in the military, space, and nuclear energy fields, other fields as well. But even so, scientists and engineers will, on the urban scene, experience difficulties. Some as follows. Initially, they will learn to their chagrin, dismay, that the market is extraordinarily fragmented. There is no Pentagon or Maryland Avenue Southwest
for research, development, and production on the urban scene. We don't even know, in confident and careful detail, what the nature of this market is. There are relatively few funds available at either the federal or the local level for research and development. There are relatively few professionals dealing with such matters at the state and local level. And the federal role in support of R&D in some of these areas is not yet clear at all, in marked contrast, I would say, to the defense and the space areas. And they will learn that it is very difficult and expensive to conduct large-scale development tests and engineering and system evaluation. Now, some, however, will find the urban problems much more difficult and strange to their past experience in such areas as housing, criminal justice, urban renewal, new community development, and so on. Not only do all of the inhibitions that I've just mentioned above prevail, but others must be appreciated. There's an extreme variation in codes and standards, locality to locality, across the country. There is a relatively primitive, in the professional sense of the word, as it is understood in the space and defense areas, a relatively primitive industry, and very few truly experienced professionals near the policy level on the local scene, capable of appreciating the necessity for experiment, for advanced planning, for program evaluation, and for sophisticated management practices. There is a lack of hard intelligence on local needs, on local desires, on local capacities, and local commitments. There is a lack of a body of tested social and political theory to depend upon in making engineering and production decisions. I might read from the Newsweek of March 24th, which quotes Noam Chomsky's book, American Power and the New Mandarins. Excuse me. The new Mandarins have based their claim to power on their special technical expertise and knowledge of managing an advanced post-industrial society. For Chomsky, this claim is unjustified, because if there is a body of theory, well tested and verified, that applies to the resolution of domestic conflict, its existence has been kept a well-guarded secret. The scientists and engineers will experience great difficulty in conducting socially and politically related experiments and development tests in the public, sensitive, and complex laboratory of the city. The great influence of race and of poverty upon nearly all activities is bound to be great. Now, the growing concern for an articulation of citizen involvement and citizen participation at the neighborhood and local level in the urban decision-making process is something quite strange, I think, to all of us as professional scientists and engineers. In the face of these circumstances, I would observe that where some scientists and engineers are headed will be influenced by the direction, by the magnitude, and by the pace of activities and decisions in the following general areas. One, the growth in true fundamental concern for our urban problems. True fundamental concern for our urban problems as evidenced in A, the placement of greater fractions of our resources, our national resources, funds, and trained professional manpower onto the study and amelioration of our humanistic urban problems. Gentlemen, here we have to appreciate that in this country and most of the countries abroad, faced as we are with growing and complex urban problems, we are playing a zero-sum game. There are very few competent, unemployed scientists and engineers. There are very few accessible dollars. If we wish to do more of this sort of work, we must do less of something else. Secondly, there must be a commitment on the part of hard scientists and engineers through working together effectively on socially and politically related problems as they are in the cities, not as they are imagined oftentimes to be in the university and in the laboratory. There must be a clarification of the federal role in the support of development and engineering activities leading to eventual commercial and industrial production of goods and services tailored specifically for the urban market. There must be deeper and more detailed scientific and technical insight into the problems of our cities, our states, and our metropolitan regions, and there must be greater knowledge and keener appreciation by scientists and engineers of the character and the advantages and limitations of urban-directed federal programs, such as, for instance, the Model Cities Program. The conduct of careful professional experiments and development tests in the cities, with the understanding and encouragement of elected and appointed officials and citizens at all levels and locations within the cities, must be given a great deal more consideration. Rationalization and coordination of urban-related scientific and technological activities among the several departments and agencies at the federal level, which have urban responsibilities, and the relationship among federal, state, and local programs, resources, and institutions. The long-term and close commitment to city and state government activities on the part of scientists and engineers, and the useful long-time coupling of multidisciplined, problem-oriented university, nonprofit, and industrial groups of professionals, hard and soft scientists, engineers, economists, lawyers, architects, and so on, with the elected and appointed officials and their staffs, addressed to the understanding and amelioration of urban problems. Well, I'll let go for the question and answer period some of the signs of progress in this regard, which I've observed personally over the past 2 years, and conclude on this note, that where the scientists and the engineers are going, where are they heading on the urban scene, in my judgment, to a very great extent, depends upon them, upon us. But not initially as scientists and as engineers, but rather primarily as citizens, as taxpayers, and as local residents. You must see that your voices are heard on the urban scene, carefully, thoughtfully, and prudently, and without compromise for your professional integrity. But you must influence better than you have to date the courses of action which relate science and technology usefully to our urban residents and their elected and appointed leaders on the city level, the state level, the metropolitan regional level, and at the national level as well. Thank you.
Dr. Severoff.
Mr. Rowe, ladies and gentlemen, in the days of continuously increasing influence of science and engineering on all branches of society life, the problem of scientific engineering progress forecasting is one of the main problems in the present. The actuality of this problem relative to the forecasting terms up to 10-15 years is universally recognized. However, there are different points of view on the question of necessity and possibility of forecasting on longer periods, e.g. up to several tens or hundreds of years. According to one of these same points, forecasting of so distant periods is impossible, and it is not necessary to be engaged in it. According to another standpoint, long period forecasts are possible, and their realization is considered to be necessary. In my speech, an attempt is made to give a forecast on the development of radio electronics and automatics for many years. If such a long period forecasting would be correct, it would be beneficial for the speeding up of the scientific engineering progress in the nearest future too. The period between the previous and this IEEE session was marked by new remarkable achievements in the fields of electrical engineering, radio electronics, automatics, and particularly in the field of space research in USSR and United States. What method it is necessary to use for long period of forecasting? The extrapolations method successfully used for near period forecastings are useless for long period forecasting, as they do not consider the profound quality leaps in the development of science and engineering. For long period forecasting, it is necessary to use specific methods. One of them is based on the investigation of possible fundamental qualitative leaps in the development of science and engineering. Nowadays, such qualitative leaps in the field of nuclear physics and energetics, solid-state physics and polymer chemistry, biology and medicine, and many other branches become imminent. The fundamental discoveries in these branches of the science will, in the not very distant future, radically change the character of science, engineering, and production. They will play a decisive role in the future development of society on the way of social progress. On the basis of analysis of possible scientific discoveries, fundamental qualitative leaps, basic terms, as well as analysis of conditions of development of science and engineering in the near and distant future, we form a scientific hypothesis that the greatest arch fundamental leap and turning point of the future development of science and engineering and in the life of human society will be the creation and discovery by the man of principally new objects and natural phenomena which had been never known before. In the forming on this arch fundamental leap, radio electronics and automatics, and first of all, electronic computers will play a decisive role, as their appearance is connected with the entry of the mankind into a new era, the era of automation of the mental work. The increase of memory capacity of electronics computers, the raise of their speed and reliability, use of technique and technology of micro-miniaturization, increase of quantity of primary elements, complications of structural connections between them, the use of hierarchical structures with an immense quantity of complex connections, the use of principle of adaptation, education, self-perfection, self-programming. These are some of the trends of the development of modern electronic computers, which on a given stage of their development, due to the implementations of social laws and inner logics of the development of these machines, inevitably will tend to discovery and establishment of new objects and natural phenomena, the general trends of their development being defined and directed by the society of people. Investigations successfully carried out in the Soviet Union and United States of America on general system theory will play a great role in the forming of analyzed above arch fundamental leap and creation of the principally new technique that will represent a system unknown before, unlike the man, nature, and modern engineering. These works are being carried out in the Soviet Union in many directions. Investigations are particularly carried out under the leadership of Professor Tsipkin in the Institute of Automatics and Telemechanics on problem of adaptive systems, at the Institute of Information Transmission Problems, or the transmission of information in physical, technical, and biological systems, and investigations of property of system models with different degree of complexity. So, for instance, while investigating the problem of existence of finite rate of information transmission in physical systems with regard to their quantum nature, Lev Levitin, a scientific worker of the Institute of Information Transmission Problems, came to the conclusion that the well-known statement of Bremerman on the relationship between maximum information and the mass of material information's carrier has to be given a more precise definition. In particular, it was stated that the final relationship between energy and quantity of information and time required for its processing depends on the physical nature of its carrier, and there is no unique fundamental limit. It was also shown that within the restrictions of the quantum nature of material carriers and relationship between the quantity of information and the product of energy per time can be made as great as possible. In January 1969, a symposium on investigation of systems was organized in Moscow by the Central Bureau of Methodological Seminars of the Presidium of Academy of Sciences of USSR, on which different aspects of modern system theory were discussed. We think that in the future, as a result of interaction of the scientific investigations of system on one hand and micro-miniaturizations on the other, principally new natural objects will be created, and above mentioned arch fundamental leaps in the development of science and engineering will occur. These new natural objects will have possibilities of self-development and self-perfection in directions given by the society of man. The complex hierarchical system consisting of new natural objects having the possibilities of self-perfection in given directions will be in the future of extreme value to the human society, as it will contribute in such a way of complete satisfaction of constantly raising material and spiritual demands of all members of the society. Allow me, in conclusion, to express the confidence that the collaboration of scientists of the Soviet Union, United States of America, and other countries are particularly the promotion of contacts between the Popov Society and the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers will undoubtedly be valuable for solving the mighty problems the lecture was devoted to. Thank you.